Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning, and welcome to another installment of What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, a time to reflect, to remember, and to stand with those who whose lives have been affected. On today's show, we share a conversation about why this awareness matters and the impact it continues to have on our community. Before we begin, this year marks the 10th anniversary of the Tribute Garden at Isle View Park, created to honor victims of domestic violence. 10 years ago, Jay Moran covered its story. Today, we take a moment to revisit that original report.
On a cool Monday morning, with the sun reflecting off the nearby Niagara River, landscapers in Isle View Park were putting the finishing touches on the Tribute Garden, a new site honoring lives affected by domestic violence. Tomorrow's dedication ceremony represents the culmination of the work of many.
My name is Saree Becker, Commissioner of Public Advocacy for Erie County, and I also act as Executive Director of the Erie County Commission on the Status of Women.
In her Rath Building office, Saree Becker outlines the long road to making the Tribute Garden a reality, the many government and nonprofit agencies who contributed time and energy to the effort. Erie County provided early seed money. A bike-a-thon and walk holding its sixth annual event tomorrow contributed funds. And a nearly $200,000 grant from the Niagara Greenway Commission turned a vision into a reality.
I would say it's going to be a very sacred space. We started this process thinking it would be something just kind of a simple memorial, but we knew it had to be very special. And so we engaged the services of a landscape architect and Joy Keebler.
So you'll notice from the plan there's the two strong walls on either end make this sort of ellipse.
Landscape architect Joy Keebler offers insight into the Tribute Garden's design elements, developed through a series of community discussions. An ellipse was chosen rather than a circle, reminding how the cycle of domestic violence needs to be broken. Thresholds are built in to respect those who have taken the courageous steps away from violent relationships. Victims are recalled by sponsored inscriptions along stone walls, another feature chosen symbolically over the footpaths often installed at other memorials.
And we had some very strong voices in those meetings that said, no one will ever walk on me again, whether figuratively or literally. And so it was imperative that nothing, no name be on the ground.
Asia Hassan, who was decapitated by her husband in the Orchard Park cable company that they operated, I was town supervisor when that happened. 6 months later, Angie Moss, gunned down, executed on the side of California Road in the shadow of Ralph Wilson Stadium.
Mary Travers Murphy is the executive director of the Family Justice Center, one of the groups behind the Tribute Garden that will stand and as a legacy at Isle View Park.
The way Joy designed the garden, it builds the sunset right and the water right into the experience of peace and a safe sanctuary. And the fact that so many people are supporting it, the community is sending a message to victims and survivors. We have your back. Enough is enough. We're going to do everything in our power to shine a bright light on this evil in our society that's domestic violence.
Travers Murphy also sees the Tribute Garden as a future gathering spot for those inevitable moments when domestic violence, once again, explodes into the community's consciousness. She runs through the startling statistics all should know. Several times a day, a woman is murdered at the hands of her abuser. One of every four women are victims of domestic violence.
Girls 14 to 16 years old to 22 to 24 years old. One in three are touched by this. And what we're finding is in kids in the younger age group, they don't have any dating experience. They don't realize being texted 450 times in an afternoon is not love. That's somebody's attempt to control them. And we want people to understand that these unhealthy, abusive relationships are about power and control.
We don't have that. We've got about
Dedication for the Tribute Garden takes place at 10 tomorrow morning, coinciding with the annual Break the Cycle Bike-a-thon and Walk at Isleview Park. We finish off with a few more numbers. Erie County handled 11,000 domestic violence calls last year. It's believed only one in six cases was reported. And to those who continue to live silently in abusive relationships, one of the Tribute Garden's stones holds a poignant inscription. It reads, "Educate, empower, survive."
That was Jay Moran reporting 10 years ago. Now we go to today's episode with Karen King, Erie County Commissioner of Public Advocacy and Director of Erie County Commission on the Status of Women, Kelly Dumas, co-founder of Dumas Rice and board member on the Status of Women, Tiffany Pavone, Director of Service at Child and Family Services, and Judith Olin, Director of Family Violence and Women's Rights Clinic at the University of Buffalo School of Law.
Let's get into some of these conversations here. Tiffany Pavone of Child and Family Services, you're the Director of Victim Services. What are you seeing right now? I mean, I hate to start listing trends and that, but why don't we just get into what you're seeing on a week in and week out basis?
In some ways, things stay the same. You know, the one in four number, one in four women, one in seven men, that statistic stays the same with regards to the impact that it's having on victims and survivors in our community. But when you look at even younger, between the ages of 18 to 24, that goes down to one in three, which is why it's so important to get students involved, because the younger we start talking about this, the better. Because once we get into long-term relations, it's that much harder to get out. What is most concerning for us as providers, I think, right at this moment, is that if we look just over the summer, we have unfortunately experienced three domestic violence homicides that we're aware of that have been identified as domestic violence homicides, because the sad thing is there have probably been other homicides that just have not been identified as domestic violence related. Every time that happens and someone hasn't been given the support or been supported by the system as we would hope they would have, that leads all of us to take an internal look at ourselves as a system to say, what could we be doing better? And one of the things that I appreciate about the Tribute Garden and being part of this conversation is the garden is a location to bring advocates together, to have a call of action when we're starting to see these trends and these concerns, not only with homicides, but with the numbers of strangulations that we see going up, the increase in demand for shelter beds. As a director of Victim Services at Child and Family Services, I oversee Haven House. And Haven House runs a 24-hour hotline, 884-6000, 24/7. You can always reach out for help. And that's more than just shelter. But we are the only licensed, confidential domestic violence shelter for our county. We have 36 beds. I will tell you, 36 beds does not come close to meeting the demand. And sadly, when we pull our statistics and our data, we turn away twice as many people than we do actually accept into the shelter, because we are at capacity almost all of the time. So one of the other things that we are seeing and as an agency are looking to do is expand our shelter, because we cannot be saying no to victims who, when they call us, they're at their most dangerous time, because the most dangerous time for a domestic violence survivor is when they draw that line in the sand and they say, I'm not going to stay in this relationship. That's the most dangerous time for them. They need to come into shelter. They need to be in a safe, confidential space. And so it is heartbreaking when you have to say, I am sorry, but I do not have any more space. We have to find a different option for you, which often means out of county, which takes a family away from their resources and their support that they have here, or a general shelter, which are fine, but they're not confidential. They don't have the same safety parameters, or a motel or hotel placed by the Department of Social Services. The reality of those are that it's the same motels and hotels that have been being used for years. It's not confidential.
Yeah.
They're not the safest options. So we need to make options more available for client for survivors. We need to increase our bed size, our capacity. So we're hoping with a current plan that we have in place and funding application submitted that we would go from 36 beds to 64. And what also would help with that is that right now, a vast majority of the survivors we turn away are families, survivors that have more than two children, because oftentimes we have a bed available, two beds available. But when you get the family of five looking for space, we rarely have that. With this expansion, this would allow us larger room capacity, ability to be more flexible with our rooms so that we can open them up to larger families if needed, but then close them off for individuals if needed as well. So we are just awaiting some funding application to make sure that we can see that through.
Tiffany, you've most certainly raised a lot of things we want to circle back to, but I want to try to get everybody into the conversation here. So I turn to Kelly Dumas. And Kelly, you come to this maybe from a little different standpoint, but you're also a member of the board on the Commission of Status of Women. So talk about that from your perspective as a mental health care provider. Talk about this issue.
So definitely, I think from a mental health lens, it's very important that survivors of domestic violence have safe spaces to process the trauma that is often related to a domestic violence experience. It does not end after an incident. The survivors, family members, community at large, there is a lot of post-trauma oftentimes that can, if not having safe spaces to talk about and process, can affect future relationships, can turn into other diagnosable situations related to mental wellness. So I definitely like to push against sometimes there's stigma related to people seeking the mental health pieces needed. And we know that survivors of domestic violence have multiple layers of needs. And so the service providers, and I'm sure the mental health component is available within the Haven House and things. But again, like the family members and others who may have witnessed or are having some aftermath effects, we want them to also have spaces to be able to seek help.
And so this is always tough when you're dealing with a provider,
yes,
especially when there's obviously privacy concerns. But at the same time, I mean, can you share with us how perhaps maybe lead people who are their victims or family members of victims, how you try to lead them through these this trauma? Because there's a lot of things that fall under the term trauma, but boy, what you might see in your own home might be something that stays with you even longer than anything else.
Absolutely. I think as mental health professionals, so we're trained. So I work with a group right now. I have a program called Building Capacity for Clinicians of Color. There's about 27 mental health clinicians in that group. And so we are trained to lead with understanding. First of all, trauma looks different to everyone. What has been experienced as trauma for one may or may not be for someone else, and the impact that it's going to have on you. So our role is to create safe environments for people to feel comfortable sharing their experience and how it has impacted them. One of the points that were brought up earlier, too, is the impact, the large impact on our youth and young adults. So we also want to make sure that as mental health providers, we are creating space that's able to be welcoming to reach our younger population. I had the opportunity in the garden to bring my son, Dennis, to do some planting. And at that time, he was a senior at St. Joe's. But it opened up an opportunity. I did not know how big domestic violence was in the young age group. So it really opened the door for conversations with relationships and even with friends, and just how common this is. And so he's in college now going for mental health. And one message that he continues to share, he's a sophomore now, is We need to have some kind of group that that's focused on relationships. And so we're working on something like that, that we can bring to the college where he is and then to some high school students so that we can, as I think Karen mentioned earlier, get them younger and talk about relationships. What is healthy relationships, having healthy boundaries, and how to seek support. And so all of those are important pieces.
And I'll just add that every February, the Commission on the Status of Women hosts a teen dating violence relationship awareness summit for students across Western New York. And we've been doing that for several years now. And we get about anywhere between 60 and 100 students who show up every February. And we work closely with several of the school districts to talk specifically about, you know, what does it mean to develop healthy relationship mm-hmm. dynamics, right? You know, because young people are taking cues from all over the place. Mm-hmm. So providing an opportunity for them to discuss it openly and learn more is really important.
Yes.
And as we were hearing from our guests here, we also could see Judith Olin giving some very emphatic affirmative head shakes to a lot of the points that were being brought up here. Judith, as we mentioned at the top, with the UB School of Law, the Family Violence and Women's Rights Clinic. Judith, I kind of strategically left you to the last to get into this because you bring in to this the legal element that's involved here. And there's still really, I think, a lack of clarity. Maybe you'd agree or disagree about what rights victims have and how our system goes about dealing with these situations. Why don't you take it from there?
Okay, thank you. First, I just want to say a little bit about the Family Violence and Women's Rights Clinic. It's a law school clinic at the University at Buffalo School of Law. It started in 1992. So it is the longest standing domestic violence related law clinic in New York State, maybe even in the country, that has been continuously operating. Second and third year law students, they get a practice order. So it's a limited order to practice law under the supervision of licensed attorneys. And they represent survivors of domestic violence in civil legal matters such as divorce, child custody, and civil orders of protection. So it's very, and interestingly, just putting a little plug, they also have developed a teen dating violence prevention PowerPoint that they present most recently at the Tapestry Charter School. Mm. So we also think about prevention. What I have seen that I find very troubling is that looking at domestic violence statistics in Erie County, on the one hand, we see violent crime decreasing, right? As reported in the Buffalo News last month, violent crime in the United States fell 4.5% in 2024, with homicides decreasing 15% from the previous year. But when we look at domestic violence statistics in Erie County, we see quite a different picture. Between 2022 and 2023, domestic violence crimes increased by 13% in Erie County. The Division of Criminal Justice Services statistics for domestic homicides, they were last updated in 2022. They show that Erie County had 15 domestic violence-related homicides, which is higher than the borough of Queens, which has over 2 million residents, more than double than Erie County. Now, we have heard some politicians and others try to blame bail reform when abusive partners murder their intimate partners. And I was interviewed in 2022 in the Investigative Post in a terrible case where a mother of three was gunned down in front of her children while wearing a bulletproof vest. And she knew that she was going to be killed and told everyone. Mm. Well, really, what the culprit there was, it had nothing to do with bail reform. The police undercharged the crime. There was a chargeable felony there that was not charged. And if it had been charged, there were two possible felonies. then the court would have been able to set bail. This individual had a very long criminal record, including bail jumping, which is key when you're setting bail. One of the major points is to assure that the accused is going to return to court. So that didn't happen. In the most recent case, the most recent murder that we've been talking about a lot in our community, it had absolutely nothing to do with bail reform.
Okay.
So this individual had initially been charged with violent felonies, including strangulation. Bail had been set at a fairly high amount. It was either $30,000 or $50,000, and the individual posted it. Well, the court also issued an order of protection as part of the condition of bail, and he violated it and was soon arrested for violating the order of protection. Now, it was only charged as a misdemeanor, which actually was appropriate, but there are some misdemeanors that are bail eligible, and it was bail eligible. And the judge let him go. And he then murdered the victim. Judges need domestic violence training. There should be a bill in New York State that requires every judge who hears domestic violence cases to receive mandatory training in domestic violence, including on risk assessment, because in this most recent case, there was strangulation. And it's sort of DV 101 that when there is strangulation, there's peer-reviewed research that it increases lethality. It increases lethality, strangulation. We know that. That has been validated by research. I dare say that the judge who let Mr. Crouch go may have had no idea. So there are some judges in Erie County. We have our integrated domestic violence court with highly trained judges and some other judges, too, who are very trained. But not all cases go to the integrated domestic violence court. A lot of them are going before lower court judges, city court judges, town and village judges, and they are not required to receive domestic violence training, which I find to be very upsetting in this day and age. I mean, we have been talking about these issues since the late 1970s. And so here we are in 2025, and we don't have that law in place. So again, the accusations against bail reform are completely misplaced here. This has nothing to do with bail reform.
Judith Olin, one of our guests today on What's Next, also with us, Tiffany Pavone, Kelly Dumas, and also Karen King, the Erie County Commissioner of Public Advocacy and Executive Director of the Erie County Commission on the Status of Women. We're going to take a time out. We're going to come back and start delving into some of these issues, many of which Judith just brought up, but also talk about domestic or partner abuse inside youth as well. There's a lot to talk about here on What's Next. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
The headlines don't stop. The world keeps moving, and through it all, you need news and information you can trust. That's where we come in. WBFO is now Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. Same station, same trusted journalism, just with a new name. From Morning Edition to All Things Considered, from Group Chat to Friday Night Lights, from What's Next to the BBC, we bring you the stories and smart conversations that matter. No spin, no nonsense, just the perfect mix of news, information, and entertainment. Listen anytime on the BTPM Listen app or btpm.org.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media produced a short documentary on creative restorations, which delivers life-saving supplies to combat overdose in Western New York.
Because we're a new agency, what happens sometimes is, you know, a lot of grant funders, they are hesitant to fund you. So we were on the fence with getting the grant before I sent them the video. It was able to show the grant funder what exactly their money was going to go towards. With that grant, that allowed us to secure a home base. Now we have a location where we do community meals, where we provide services right then and there. So I think the importance is you guys were able to really put boots on the ground with us, really show the city in a lens that you don't commonly see. So I think it helps to raise awareness to some of the issues that we have in our city, but also what else left do we have to do as a community to better our community? Please, if you can, fund public media. Make sure that they're available because they really put a harder focus on the community and it really gives a better view of what we really need to get done here.
Contact Congress now at protectmypublicmedia.org.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next. With us today, Judith Olin, Tiffany Pavone, Kelly Dumas, and Karen King, the Erie County Commissioner of Public Advocacy and Executive Director of the Erie County Commission on the Status of Women. If you've just joined us, we are talking fairly extensively about domestic violence in this program. And I guess we should serve that as a bit of a content warner, warning, I guess, of sorts, because needless to say, there's a lot in this that is can lead to some fairly graphic discussion for sure. Karen, the coalition, Erie County Coalition on Family Violence.
Well, I'm going to hand that over to Tiffany in a second, but what I wanted to say, Jay, is that this idea that this is a community problem, I think is becoming abundantly clear that we know that there's not just one approach to understanding this problem. And you have to remember, contextually, the 1970s was really the beginning of the movement to discuss this as a public community concern. Prior to that, domestic violence was private, behind closed doors, a family matter, right? So it didn't have the legal support behind it. It didn't have advocates. It didn't have resources. So when we look at it through that lens, I mean, 1970s was a while ago, but it wasn't that long ago. And so there's still some misconceptions around what intimate partner violence is. I mean, it's a crime.
Misconceptions?
Yeah, well, that it's a family issue or an individual issue or it's a bad actor or a bad apple, but this is a community problem because we live in a society that embraces violence and oftentimes uses violence as a way to negotiate, settle scores, exert power. So there are all different components going on. So the education piece, particularly focusing on young people to create awareness and give them models of what healthy relationship dynamics look like is an important piece. But I'm going to pivot to Tiffany because the work that she does isn't just specific to the agency she represents, but to the entire community.
Thanks, Karen. So the Erie County Coalition Against Family Violence, I serve as its community relations chair, is really a grassroots organization that did start in 1978, and it was a way for the community to come together as a whole. It's not just a woman's issue, it's a community issue. And we needed everyone from service providers to law enforcement to the judicial system to survivors themselves and the families that are impacted by it to come to the table and work together with regards to what are the changes that we need to see in our system, what should we be advocating for with our representatives with regards to laws that sometimes get in place, like bail reform, that may not have had an impact on these specific cases, but still have had a negative impact with regards to domestic violence and being able to really support survivors and help maintain their safety. So it is the coordinated community response to intimate partner violence and domestic violence in our community is the coalition. And while we are dealing with these tragedies that continue to happen over the summer and really raise concern amongst us and those of us that are really focused on this issue, at the same time, we have an opportunity right now. We have this coordinated community response. Governor Hochul also just issued a large amount of funding across the state to enhance coordinated community response in communities. Erie County was one of those that not only enhances the coalition, but also enhances our high-risk team that Haven House and Child and Family Services coordinates. And that's a multidisciplinary team that hopes to prevent these homicides, because if they are brought to our team and our table, we can create safety plans as a group, as a team, to work with each other so that everybody knows that is working on this case what the police are doing, what the courts are doing, what attorneys are doing, what the advocates are doing, so that we can work together on a safety plan. Because these are the cases that we use danger assessments for, to realize that they're at the highest level of lethality and that these cases could go lethal very quickly if we don't take action and create a safety plan in conjunction with the victim. Because I also want to make sure that as a community, we do this as a survivor-empowered, survivor-centered way of because you cannot tell a survivor what they need to do. Nobody understands a survivor situation better than the survivor that is experiencing it themselves. They have been able to maintain their safety up to this point. We have to trust that we can work in conjunction with them to let them know, here are the options and the ways our system can help support you. What do you think is best for you and your family, and how can we input that? So I'm really excited to say that this funding has allowed us to fully fund our high-risk team, has added additional supports to the Erie County District Attorney's Office, which now has separated out the Domestic Violence Bureau. So it is a standalone bureau focused on domestic violence, because that's the way we do need focused and specially trained prosecutors on these cases that fully understand the dynamics of domestic violence and the complexities that come along with that. Oftentimes, you will hear people talk about cases didn't go through because victims were uncooperative. I hate that word. They're not uncooperative. They are traumatized. They are scared. They are trying to keep themselves and their families safe. And sometimes going through the criminal justice system isn't the safest route for them. And so we can't push them through that. We have to help support them through what is the most safest. And maybe that is a civil order of protection. But if that is issued, are we doing what we need to do to enforce that order of protection? Because along with strangulations, there is gun involvement. And when there's gun involvement, someone is 750% more likely to have their lives ended by that gun that is in that household. And so when I had mentioned earlier that so there are probably homicides that have not come across as domestic violence homicides, it is because our district attorney's office has even indicated that a lot of our domestic violence victims that we're able to reach to come through the DA's office because there's been a gun charge, not a domestic violence charge, not because a survivor has come forward, because they're usually too scared to do so, but because the offender has gotten picked up on a gun charge. And so there's our opportunity to make sure that we're stepping in and implementing the resources that that survivor needs. Probation department is getting ankle monitors to be proactively monitoring DV offenders who are put on probation. It is becoming a standard term in their probation that they are to have that monitor, and it is proactively monitored. It's not a system just to say, oh my God, the survivor had interaction with their offender and was injured. What happened? Let's see if that person was around. No, it's an alert that they are around the survivor when they aren't supposed to be, and we can be proactive about that. So there are steps being taken right now, but it is incredibly important that we work together, that everybody that has a role and is a stakeholder in this in our community comes to the table. Law enforcement, the judges, this is where judge training becomes critically important because we talk about enforcement of orders of protection. Are judges even aware of, you know, what they have the jurisdiction and ability to do to ensure that guns are removed? Sometimes they're not aware because for a long time, civil judges didn't have the same authority as criminal judges. They do now. Are judges aware of that? Are they trained on that? So there is momentum for some great, wonderful work to enhance and strengthen. But again, we need to work together as a true, full ecosystem, that we're all working together, coming to the table, putting egos aside and saying, this is not working well right now. We need to change it.
Tiffany brought up a lot of good points, but what I couldn't help but think when Karen was kind of going through a little bit of history here about, we're going back to the 70s and things started becoming a little more illuminated, we could say, right? And perhaps maybe even back in those days and before, you could even maybe say popular culture did a certain disservice by, if not ignoring domestic violence, I don't want to say glorifying it, but most certainly making it almost something that is just part of life. And I guess what I'm asking our panel here, and this is where we can all can kind of jump in, but so if it started in the 70s and we started illuminating this, but yet the numbers sit so, you know, dangerously high. What's missing? What's missing in the daily conversation? What do you feel is lacking or should be highlighted more to make this issue so prominent that a judge wouldn't think of not getting this training or, you know, these different elements that are missing? I'm just curious, Kelly, I'm kind of looking at you for this to start this conversation.
Right. Well, one thing that has been coming to mind as we're having this conversation that is important to the work that I do is I think that as whether it's service providers or systems, it is important that we also highlight the cultural differences that impacts this, and that we are educated in cultural differences that can lead to domestic violence and prevent individuals from seeking help. When we talk about various communities of color, these various systems that exist, the judicial system, law enforcement, child protection may be involved. These are systems that have not been historically favorable to individuals of color. And so we can't ignore that. And so I think part of the education piece as providers in a system is we have to get an understanding of, one, what are some of the, there are, as a mental health provider, I've been asked to come into some spaces and working with communities of color. Being a person of color, I am not an expert on the various cultural norms that impact different cultures. And it's not necessary that we're experts, but we have to lean in with a curious, open mind. And so what I have learned is because of upbringing and reinforced beliefs that we can't just dismiss, it leads to a lot of unaddressed issues. It can lead to domestic violence being kept quiet. And so we have to create environments where it's safe for people to talk about those things and educate ourselves. So I think the judges, the law enforcement, everyone. So as we approach the issue, just understanding that it's multi-layered, and we have to do our parts to ensure that we are creating spaces that everyone can kind of feel that help is available to them.
Judith Olin, I turn back to you now. You bring that legal expertise to this conversation, and we heard Tiffany talk about, you know, everybody's got to be on board, everybody's got to be the same, but are there flaws in the laws that we're missing right now? I mean, I thought you did a great job of illuminating some of the discussion about bail reform previously, but what about that? What do you see?
Well, unfortunately, there are other problems as well. You know, we have over 20 separate police agencies in Erie County, and they all have their own policies and procedures. And, you know, I think, as Tiffany said, there are some survivors that do not wish to use the criminal justice system, that prefer to use the civil justice system because their autonomy, they can decide if they want to, quote unquote, withdraw the charges, et cetera. Whereas in the criminal system, it is the state against the offender, and the survivor, they can go and tell the assistant DA or the judge they want to drop the charges, but they're not allowed to.
Okay.
Right? Because it's the state. Now, unfortunately, so when a survivor is entitled to go and get file a family offense petition in family court the same day or the next day. So that is when there's high risk involved, they can go right in. They can have, you know, it's an abbreviated hearing before a judge. Many times the court will issue what we call a temporary ex parte order of protection. It means that the abusive partner is not there, but the court schedules a quick turnaround so that the abusive partner, you know, has the opportunity to, you know, obviously be heard. But when these temporary orders of protection are issued, they are not enforceable until they're actually served on the abusive partner. So they're not enforceable until they're served. And we have unfortunately seen problems with some police agencies that do not promptly serve orders of protection. And is this because they're bad people? No, of course not. It has to do with certain staffing rules that we've been told that everyday patrol officers are not allowed to serve the orders of protection, that it's only a specialized group of detectives who's allowed to serve the orders of protection. And this specialized group of detectives has many, many, many obligations. So we have been trying to advocate to change that rule so that these temporary orders of protection can be served by any police officer, which is what you have in most agencies in Erie County. The other, while we're talking about police, I do want to talk about the Lethality Assessment Program. This is an evidence-based program that was developed by the Maryland Network Against Domestic Violence in 2005. It is used by law enforcement when responding to a domestic call. It was correlated with a dramatic drop in intimate partner homicides in Maryland. Now, there are some New York State police departments, such as Dutchess County and Westchester County, they are using the Lethality Assessment Program. Now, this has been discussed with in Erie County, and what I heard people say is, well, no, we don't need to do that because blah, blah, blah. All right. A bill has now been drafted which would require all law enforcement officers to conduct a lethality assessment. And again, this is an evidence-based risk assessment protocol. This bill has passed in the New York State Senate. It has numerous sponsors in the New York State Assembly. And I hope that we can get that bill passed because this law enforcement response is shown to respond better. It has been linked with a decrease in domestic violence homicides in Maryland. We have police agencies in New York State that are using it. We need to become more proactive. As I indicated earlier, our statistics in Erie County are poor. We can't keep doing the same old thing. And as Tiffany said,
No, that's quite
You're
right.
Fine.
Okay. As Tiffany said, we do have new funding. We have new funding that is going to make, you know, ameliorate things, hopefully. But I think we have to consider embracing the lethality assessment program in Erie County as well.
And if I could just add to that, because Judith is right with this funding, one of the things that comes as a requirement is that you use an evidence-based, law enforcement uses an evidence-based lethality tool. And the lethality assessment that Judith is talking about is not, it's used nationally. There's many states that have already passed this law to say it is a requirement because of the impact that it has had. And in fact, if many people know about the case that went nationally with Gabby Petito and their family are strong advocates that if that had been performed at the time that that case was being looked at by law enforcement, that may have ended differently than in two people losing their lives. And actually, I've been to trainings now where that tape of the interview by law enforcement of Gabby, as well as the offender, is used as a training tool now with regards to why the lethality assessment should really need to be part of what we do. And for high-risk teams, the lethality assessment is the number one way to get cases referred directly from law enforcement to the high-risk team. Because as we also know as service providers, DV advocates are usually not the first person a DV survivor or DV victim has access to when they are trying to ultimately make a change and potentially leave. It is often law enforcement or the courts. So it is they have a better opportunity many times to make an initial connection with that survivor and then get them connected with a DV advocate that can do further safety planning. So I just wanted to add to the importance of utilizing that evidence-based lethality assessment.
We're going to skip our final break here and just keep it right here because we only have so much time and I want to make sure that we touch upon things. Just repeating our guests today, Karen King, Kelly Dumas, Tiffany Pavone, and Judith Olin, and this lethality assessment. Can we get into the details of that just a little bit more, what that really means? Because, you know, it's come up now. It's obviously a key issue here. It's something that's perhaps could be passed, but has not moved through the assembly. What about it?
So lethality assessments and danger assessments have been used by domestic violence advocates for years now. And in Erie County, all domestic violence providers have an agreement through our work on the coalition that we all use Dr. Jackie Campbell's danger assessment.
Okay.
That is a 21-question assessment of the top red flags of when a situation might go lethal. And then as an advocate, we utilize that as a way to safety plan for someone because we can determine whether or not they've been strangled in the past, if there have been suicidal threats, if there's children that aren't children of the offender. All of these things escalate the potential lethality. There is a similar tool that is a little bit shortened for law enforcement to ask very similar questions so that at a scene, when they arrive at a scene and they ask these questions, it can be realized right then and there that this is a situation that could go lethal and should be connected to a domestic violence advocate or the high-risk team. So all it is the police asking 15 questions or 12 questions, depending on which lethality.
Can you give me an example of a question that might be asked?
Sure. Have you ever been, has anybody ever blocked your airway or prevented you from breathing? Oftentimes, if you say strangulation means different things to different people, and they'll say no when they maybe, it wasn't hands around the neck. It was some other way that their airway was constricted.
Wow.
So we want to make sure we ask that. Has the violence escalated in the last few weeks? Because an escalation of violence is a clear sign. Have you attempted to leave in the past? Are there children in the home that are not related to the offender? Is there any substance abuse or alcohol issues with the offender? So these are the questions that the strangulation one is so important because for us, we know that someone has already been within minutes, if not seconds, of taking someone's life. So, and I will also tell you that as DV providers, when someone tells us reveals to us that they've been strangled, it's never, they've only been strangled once. It's multiple times. So we know that the next time they do it could very well end their lives. And so that question is in every lethality assessment. Oh, and whether or not there were guns involved, that's a huge question as well, right? Because as I indicated, when guns are involved, it significantly increases the potential for lethality. So that's just a few of the questions.
Sure.
But yeah.
Yeah. And another question is, does the survivor think that the abusive partner is capable of killing them?
It's quite a question to ask.
Mm-hmm. And this tool is also used for survivors to begin to realize the severity of their situation because most survivors don't even realize the risk of lethality they're facing until an advocate asks these questions. And please know that we don't ask these questions in a very clinical, check the box way. It's a conversation, right? To get that survivor to realize everything that they're dealing with and all of the safety concerns that are there, it really is a moment for survivors to realize, oh my gosh, you know, this is a lot more dangerous than I thought.
And you also mentioned connecting the individual then with an advocate, domestic violence advocate. What needs to happen for that to take place?
So it's very simple. You can just call our hotline number, 884-6000. The police can call that number, the national number, and that will also get them connected. That's on the domestic incident report. So when police show up, if they do the lethality assessment, they realize there's a need for a victim to get connected with an advocate, they can call right there with the survivor, which is always very beneficial, or give that number to the survivor to call later on. But we would really highly recommend that they call right then and there and make that connection. We also have advocates that are co-located throughout the system so that if someone goes to family court because they feel like, okay, I think I need an order of protection, we have advocates co-located at family court so that they can meet with the client, help them fill out that order of protection petition, but then also stay connected with them to safety plan, to follow up, because you can get your emergency order of protection and that will get you a temporary order. But unfortunately, you're going to have to go back to court probably a variety of times to make that order of protection permanent. So we want to make sure that they have the support that they need to get through that process, because it's not easy having to realize that on more than one occasion, you're going to have to go to court, face your offender, and any of the kind of manipulative tactics that they might use while you're in court. So we have that connection. If their first connection with the system is Child Protective Services, because there's been a call to police and now CPS has been involved because the children were present, we have a co-located advocate at Child Protective Services. So if it's DV related, Child Protective Services can refer to the advocate and get that survivor connected with an advocate for that additional support. We also have advocates co-located in many of the town and village jurisdictions in Amherst, in Cheektowaga, in Lancaster, Depew. So if someone comes in because they have filed or police have been called and charges are pressed, they need to get connected with an advocate, either to go through with the criminal process or just to get a report so they can document it. Our advocates are there as well. So there's a variety of ways that survivors can get connected. And also why I always love the opportunity to let people know that we're out there in the community. You can call that number, but even if you're just in the court system, you don't know what to do, there's an advocate there for you.
We are winding down to our last couple of minutes here, believe it or not. This has gone far too fast, and obviously there's a lot to discuss here. We started off our conversation talking about the Tribute Garden out at Isle View Park. 10th anniversary is upon us. It's interesting to start off talking about a space that's meant to be of honor and peace. And now here we've been able to get into just, I think, just scratching the surface about this, Karen King.
Yes.
What about, you know, what, I guess, call to action? What would you like to tell people?
Well, October's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and, you know, we're a culture that focuses on these months. You know, obviously, we want to have a perpetual sense of awareness and community engagement all year round. I think what is very clear is that this is a very complex issue because it's called intimate partner violence. So the relationship, the intimate relationship between the folks that are engaged in this relationship makes it different than other criminal activity, even though it's a crime. And I think that once all the different community members who are engaged in this work, particularly law enforcement and the judicial system, that this requires a real holistic understanding of why this form of violence exists in our culture. And it really is part of a larger conversation around violence, which we don't have time to get into today, Jay, but the idea of an ecosystem, I think, really speaks volumes. You know, we want to create an ecosystem where everyone is working together with the understanding that this is a community problem and that violence cannot become normalized just because you love somebody. I mean, these are really complex issues, and that's why it's so important to reach young people early to give them, you know, a blueprint of what does it mean to be in a healthy, mutually respectful relationship with somebody.
We are actually down to our last minute, so I want to leave it with this. Tiffany, the number again to call if somebody needs help
is 716-884-6000, 24/7.
Thank you very much for that. And I want to thank everybody for being here and bringing a lot of light to this issue. Obviously, we've opened up a lot of doors and we could have many more conversations. And I guess that's something we'll have to shoot to do. Again, thanks, Kelly Dumas, for being with us today. Judith Olin, thank you very much for some powerful statements and explanations here for us today. Tiffany Pavone, and also, of course, Karen King, the Erie County Commissioner of Public Advocacy, Executive Director, Erie County Commission on the Status of Women. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.